If you are anything like me, your nightstand might have a fun-filled drawer buzzing with pleasurable options, but there is one favorite that has stood the test of time for over 30,000 years, the humble dildo. Proof of masturbation extends prehistory, and the evidence can be found in prehistoric rock paintings and other petroglyphs. The earliest tool used as a dildo dates back to the Ice Age, thought to have come about the same time our ancestors figured out fire, suggesting importance and value in this basic urge, or at least that they didn't think twice about attending to it. Over time, dildos evolved as better material became available. We began to see ivory and wood replicas, though I cannot imagine these to be very comfortable. Leather stuffed and sewn into a phallic pillar was a popular choice compared to its counterparts, glass being another favorite. You most likely wouldn't have made these for yourself. You would have to know where to go to request this special craft and purchase them through discreet locations. Cheaper versions could be found in and around the markets and were hidden in everyday normal objects like a loaf of bread. And for many people, I imagine they just made do with what was on hand. Maybe it was the handle of your hairbrush, the end of a broom, or even a vegetable from your garden. One thing is certain, humans have always been creative when it comes to finding that unique fulfillment. Welcome to Deviant History, where our curiosities take us back in time to uncover our salacious past in the beginning of something deviant. I'm your host, Alexandra Noel. What we know of dildos isn't just restricted to amusing archaeological finds. We see very clear depictions of dildos in a range of art and literature from the ancient world. Greeks spoke of them in their comedic plays, one mentioning an eight-fingered dildo. Greek men were also known for supplying their wives with dildos to keep them satisfied while away from home for long periods of time. Their manhood was not threatened by the imposter, seeing this as a beneficial solution for everyone involved. Other texts from around the world, including the Arabian Nights, mention fruit, vegetables, and other phallic-like objects being used for sexual pleasure. It even gets a mention in the Bible. This is thought to be the very first literary mention of use. You can find it in Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 17, where God reprimands the people of Jerusalem because they took the gold and silver that he has given them and made phallic images and fornicated with them. However, dildos didn't arrive in the UK until the 1500s. They were not as accessible or widely accepted as they are today. By this time, the Catholic Church set the tone on sexuality, and it was regarded as a necessary evil. Sex was shameful enough as it is, and the view on masturbation was worse, and sometimes a punishable offense. Our earliest reference were, for the first time spelled out in print, D-I-L-D-O, is found in an English poem titled The Choosing of Valentines. Written in 1593 by Thomas Nash and is believed to be commissioned by a man named Henry Wriothesley, 3rd Earl of Southampton. The Renaissance author was a satirical writer that lived penniless most of his life. His poems were not what brought him his recognition, but he did write them. He followed the popular style of his time and, like most Renaissance men, believed poetry to be the highest form of enlightenment and virtue. The Choosing of Valentines is a story about a man who recounts a visit to his lover on Valentine's Day. And what makes it truly riveting is not only does This poem walks us through a firsthand account of his sexual encounter with his lover, Frances. But she happens to be a sex worker. It's considered to be the most notorious literature of its time. It starts with his dedication to the Right Honorable the Lord S., where Thomas asks for his sympathy and not to look down on him for putting his name to such smut. For what he writes is merely something that all men do. He proudly asserts that everyone can write a beautiful love sonnet, full of compliments and praises. No one, however, has written successfully of love's pleasures, hinting that the only exception being himself, and that if his reader keeps an open mind, what follows will bring him much pleasure. His poem begins with a young man named Tomlin. Tomlin explains that it's Valentine's Day, and on this special day, most couples will stroll in the park, locking arms where they laugh and be flirtatious, and that they might stop by their local sweet shop to purchase cakes, where they then go off to find a nice shady spot to enjoy their confectionaries and just sit and celebrate in their love. But his sweetheart? Well, the journey begins. He makes his way to pay a visit to his sweetheart's establishment, where he will have to travel to the country to see her. Upon arriving, he discovers that she has been driven away by the local authorities and now resides in a brothel in the city. Of course, this does not stop his love, and so he pursues her there. Knocking on the front door, the madam of the house, who he describes as a very large woman with multiple chins that would take 3 men of his size to take down, he says that she demands payment before entering, a sort of cover charge, if you will. The narrator pays his entry fee, of course, and is then led into the house where he's escorted to a room to sit and wait. Before long, the madam returns and Tomlin is offered a selection of beautiful women. He compliments the ladies but declines, explaining that he is here to see Frances. The madam speaks up and says, "Oh, the holy dame and God's own mother," complimenting the man's taste. The hostess boasts of her lavish velvet gowns, fawns over her ribbons and ruffles, and makes mention of her fine and in-style wigs, says she cannot maintain her favorite for less than a crown a day. To see her, it would cost him. He says to the madam that she assesses him wrong in his wealth and charged him her highest rate, but he will not negotiate her price, that Frances is worth all the crowns in England. He beams with pride when he lays his eyes on his lover, claiming her to be the keeper of his heart. Frances meets him with matched enthusiasm. Tomlin cannot bear it any longer and with great desperation makes haste to her bed. Taking in her naked beauty and describing her as having a lofty butt, Tomlin is now overly excited and having trouble getting hard. He grows frustrated that nothing he does is having any effect on his limp member. He curses himself for failing as a man, but sweet Frances has the remedy. The poem reads this: "I kiss, I clap, I feel, I view at will. Yet dead he lies, not thinking good or ill. Unhappy me," says she, "and it will not stand? Come, let me rub and chafe it with my hand." But the next line truly captures human nature. "Perhaps the silly worm is labored sore, and wearied it can do no more. If it be so, as I am great at dread, I wish 10,000 times I were dead." Tomlin reflects on the situation and is truly mortified, but Frances was eager to see him through, and, in his words, she dandled it and danced it up and down, and she succeeded in her endeavor, and it came back with a vengeance. Not even the poem itself wastes any time progressing. He rubbed and pricked and pierced her to the bones, digging as far as earth he might for stones. Now high, now low, now striking short and thick, now diving deep, he touched her to the quick. His lover tries to slow him down, grabbing his hips to set the pace. Frances insists that he not finish so quickly. She pleads with Tomalin, saying that she wants to come too, and so she begins to rock her hips against him in a way that will bring her to an orgasm. Tomalin looks down upon Frances, remarking on her radiant glow as she gets closer to reaching her climax, comparing her to the glory of the sun god Apollo, declaring that no man could deny her beauty. Unable to resist a moment longer, Tomalin blows his load, and my oh my, how some things never change. After recovering, he asks Frances if she came. Her reply was a sweetly sarcastic, "No, my dearest," and continues with saying that 15 minutes is hardly enough time, and there is no reason for her to be denied such joy. And if he does not care enough to see that she is fulfilled, she will do it herself. Wrapped in silk, Frances reveals a glass dildo and begins to pleasure herself. Tomalin, not wanting to be usurped, suggests that if she just help a little, he could go again. Frances wasn't having it and bids him goodbye, and she declares, "My little dildo shall supply their kind, a canoe that moves as light as leaves by wind, that bendeth not nor fold any deal, but stands as stiff as he were made of steel." Frances then swears off men, stating that she doesn't need his or any man's help for that matter. Tomalin is offended, cursing the dildo, calling it a senseless counterfeit. He describes it as being more than enough, standing two handfuls high, straight, round, and plump, but that it only has one eye. It could never replace everything great about a man, and that it can ride a chariot straight to hell. And he just sits and watches Frances get off. Thomas Nash returns as he brings his story to an end, saying this is not just a falsehood tale for entertainment, but a real life experience. And he asks his reader, "Judge, gentlemen, if I deserve no thanks." It's not often dildos survive the harsh elements of time. They were often constructed of organic material that would break down over the course of hundreds of years. Or they were concealed in a secret location, like the brickwork of your chimney or under the loose floorboard, hidden away until stumbled upon by accident. And in the case of our very first stone prototype, it's hard to prove what it was actually used for without the hard facts, even if it's clear to us. But every now and then, we are lucky enough to unearth an antique plaything that tickles our perverted curiosities. For instance, a large 18th century perfectly preserved leather dildo was found in what used to be the bathroom at a school of swordsmanship in Poland. This school would have been primarily attended by men, and it likely belonged to one. It measures 8 inches and is said to be quite thick. It's stuffed with a bristly center, and the leather would have been polished and buffed with oil. And the tip was fitted with a smooth wood end for easy penetration. This dildo was thought to have been thrown down the toilet, whether it was by accident or out of fear of being caught, well, that part is unclear. And in the most peculiar case of a dildo, in a convent just outside of Paris sat an armchair that went untouched for over 100 years. Sewn into the seat laid an 18th century dildo that was concealed in a velvet patchwork bag. It's made of ivory, slick to the touch, and quite shiny, but this was no ordinary dildo. It was equipped with a plunger. The dildo is hollow, and to use it properly, you fill it preferably with warm milk, then push the plunger from the base all the way through to simulate ejaculation. These dildos were meant to be used with a partner. The mechanics weren't solo friendly and required assistance in operating. In other cases of these being used, they were often outfitted with a feature that you could strap on for hands-free use until the big finale. This type of dildo was widely used and had been for hundreds of years. I don't know about you, but when a convent comes to mind, a certain image is conjured. I see dark, depressing walls, strict, virtuous women devoting their lives to God's work, and I imagine them in their long, plain black dresses and overbearing white veils, walking to and fro to Mass several times a day with their noses stuck in their prayer book. However, these monasteries were full of ordinary women from all walks of life that weren't necessarily there on some religious calling. In the 1700s, there were many reasons why you would send your daughters to a convent. Women deemed hysterical or defiant would be sent away by their families. An old spinster of 27 might even see this as a less shameful way to live out the rest of their lives. Or your family is simply too poor to afford your upkeep. Whatever the case, they were warm-blooded women with needs and desires just like you and me. They did not try to pray it away with Hail Marys or resist in temptation out of fear of committing a sexual sin. No, no, no. They smuggled in dildos that spurted warm milk to fulfill their need for that delicious balm of life. I love it when deviant women slip through the cracks of time, revealing our nature as human beings that like to fuck too. My favorite thing about this entire scenario is the kink factor of sexualizing the taboo and erotic dangers of unprotected sex. And make no mistake, due to the nature and function of this dildo, it was used for one thing and one thing only. And no, we do not have proof that two horny nuns used this dildo as a means of pleasuring one another. But under such circumstances, you will never be able to convince me otherwise. Most likely, it would have been illegal to purchase a dildo in the 18th century. Places like England and America had strict laws regarding the use of such instruments. Men were growing increasingly more paranoid of being replaced as women were turning more and more towards open masturbation. And the penalties for selling dildos were harsh, as there were several accounts of merchants being imprisoned for trying to import them from France to England. In the late 1800s, America was passing the Comstock Laws. This basically restricted sending anything obscene in the mail, a very common means of receiving goods. It was headed by a political postal worker named Anthony Comstock, who worked for such organizations such as the Society for the Suppression of Vice. The law reads as this: "No obscene book, pamphlet, picture, print, or any other publication of a vulgar or indecent character, or any letter or postcard, shall be carried in the mail, and any person who shall knowingly deposit or cause to be deposited for mail or delivery any such obscene publication shall be deemed guilty of a misdemeanor, and on conviction thereof shall, for every such offense, be fined no more than $500, or imprisoned not more than 1 year, or both according to the circumstance and aggravation of the offense." It also mentions any representation, figure, or cast instrument, meaning dildos were now deemed illegal to mail in the U.S. Many dildos were being marketed as medical devices to help men pleasure their wives who suffer from erectile dysfunction or other limiting disabilities. For every man out there afraid of the dildo is another man who just wants to please his wife. Even though these instruments of pleasure did not represent the penis in the truest form and were deemed a medical device, did nothing to help escape the obscenity laws in place. And couples and solos alike were forced to source their phallic prosthetics underground. By the 1940s, the realistic rubber dildo is introduced as a marital aid. They were only available in a Caucasian flesh tone, and they had convincing details such as raised, faint blue veins, and sometimes even pubic hair. However, they were made with PVC rubber, which was an irritant to many users, and it was porous, meaning it could not be cleaned properly, but they were relatively accessible and cheap to obtain. To keep the rubber erect, a large metal spring made up the core. This was problematic, dangerous, and unreliable, with some reports stating injuries were suffered from the metal piercing through the plastic. It wasn't until the 1960s when a very famous ventriloquist named Ted March saw an opportunity to improve the dangerous options that were available at the time. Ted crafted his own dummies, assembling them from scratch using the molds he designed himself. He would then fill the molds with a liquid plastic, and they would set, creating pieces to build his little characters. The parts of the dummies that were made of the rubbery plastic, such as the arms and legs, created such a lifelike feel that he spotted this potential upgrade as a safer alternative to the prosthetic replacement. This product was able to hold its shape, being firm on its own while still flexible, but it still failed the cleaning test. They were also a bit rigid and uncomfortable, but this was still progress. Around the same time, another man hits the dildo scene. His name is Gosnell Duncan, a Grenada immigrant living in Brooklyn, New York, and finding employment as a mechanic for heavy machinery. He suffers a tragic work accident, rendering him paralyzed from the waist down. As he's recovering in his hospital bed, reflecting on his new life, he looks over to his beautiful girlfriend sitting lovingly by his side, and the realization hits him. He's never going to have sex with her again. He thinks his life is over, but it's not. And his girlfriend became his wife before they ever left the hospital. And Gosnell goes on to change our sex lives forever. Gosnell became an active participant in the disability community that grew into a nationwide movement in the 1960s. They were gaining rights, liberties, and access to public spaces. It was bringing awareness to the lives of many. In the 70s, Gosnell attended a disability conference where they were having a seminar on the challenges of sex. This topic was very important to him, and he was able to meet with others with the same interest and enthusiasm for improving their sex lives and having access to safer, more enjoyable props. One issue remained. The outdated Comstock laws were still very much active. However, thanks to an amendment, it did loosen the restrictions on mailing medical devices. And as it stood, dildos fell into that category. There were still problems with this. First, it extended only to heterosexual married couples. And the manufacturing of these prosthetics was completely unregulated. To top it off, not many people were exactly blazing the way of innovation for a still largely illegal product. Gosnell realized he could help people, and he genuinely wanted to. He had knowledge of a material called silicone. He worked with it in the past and was impressed with its ability to maintain its shape and structure under intense heat. And the texture, it was better than the standard harder plastic being used. This was soft, hard and flexible all at the same time, and best of all, it didn't smell of harsh chemicals. Gosnell took his concept to a company called General Electric and worked with a chemist for months perfecting the formula until it was everything you needed for a safe and pleasurable experience. He got to work setting up his dildo factory in the basement of his home, selling them under the name Paramount Therapeutic Products. With a high priority on safety, and for the first time ever introducing inclusive shades of brown, Gosnell sets the industry standards for years to come. but even with top-of-the-line products, he wasn't getting the sales to cover the bills. A need was out there, and he knew the free love of the 1960s missed the mark when it came to self-love, and masturbation was just still regarded as a taboo subject. But something was happening in the 70s. Feminists from all over the world began to speak up on women's rights, and our dear lady lesbians emerged with a roar, but they had a thing or two to say about dildos. And being a potentially large consumer, Gosnell listened to what they had to say. But the thing is, if you were a feminist, you weren't supposed to get pleasure from penetration. And furthermore, to use an instrument so clearly portraying a penis is a crime against the matriarchy. But that didn't mean they stopped using them or other phallic objects. They just didn't admit to it. Of course, women are getting off to penetration because it feels good. Gosnell got in touch with Del Williams, the owner of Eve's Garden, a feminist sex shop in New York City. He wanted to sell his products in her store, but Del was unconvinced her customers would even purchase them. And tired of the same model over and over, asks him why it has to look like a cock at all. This was a revolutionary thought. Gosnell wants to conduct a survey with Del's clients and she agrees. The results are in. They said it wasn't about size, it was about substance. They wanted something not necessarily large, but definitely tapered. Not particularly wide, but rippled in the midsection. Something soft and easy to care for, and something in a pretty color. That was all the inspiration Gosnell needed, and once again he paves the way in sexual pleasure and gives us the Venus, the world's first feminist dildo. It was available in the colors of chocolate brown and pale pink, and best of all, no defining characteristics of a penis. It was designed with a woman's pleasure in mind, and it changed the future of the sex toy industry forever. Within driving distance, there is probably a store you could walk into right now, with wall after wall decorated with a variety of dildos, ranging in sizes from 4 inches to horse dick. Some are double-ended for double the pleasure. The colors range from flesh to all colors of the rainbow, some wiggle and some squirt. Today, our options of self-pleasuring tools are boundless. Whatever your fantasy desires, there is something for you. If there is a spot to hit, there is a toy for the job. And even more convenient is we are only one click away on our phones or computers to an even wider selection straight from our wildest dreams, all with the promise of discreet shipping right to your front door. There was a very clear line in our history that marked the start of the sexual dark ages that preceded our ancient pagan ancestors. But since then, brave and courageous women and men continue to make waves that can be felt in the sexual renaissance of today. But the Enlightenment has yet to come. Places in America like Texas and Alabama still have laws that regulate the sales of dildos. And countries like India and Saudi Arabia prohibit them altogether. If something as natural as masturbation cannot be accepted by the masses, I'm afraid our sexual liberties have a long way to go. But one thing is evident. The human species, for over 30,000 years, have lovingly tended to a very primal instinct. That burning urge to release the lustful buildup is, and always will be, of great importance to our race. If you enjoyed this episode, please show it some love. You can find me on Facebook. Look for the group Deviant History and let me know what you think. And of course, you can listen to Deviant History wherever you get your podcasts. I hope to see you there.